This is Ryan, the host of Living Downstream. The focus of this weekend's episode is something that impacts all of us, everywhere on Earth, climate change. You'll hear from Stuart Leibowitz of the Douglas County Global Warming Coalition and Katrina Kelleher of the Northwest Indian Fisheries Commission about local impacts and ways to move forward. Before we get started, I'd like to do a land acknowledgement. It's important to remember the historical context of the place in which we live. We were not the first people here. Indigenous groups, including Cow Creek Umpqua, Coquille, Malala, and others, lived on and tended the land prior to European settlement and were displaced against their will. Anyone who's lost their home or even had a school project altered or wrecked by another person can only begin to understand the generational trauma inflicted on these groups. Beginning in this way helps us to come from a place of humbleness and respect as we dive into any topic we wish to engage in dialogue about. That is part of the story. Our first interview today is with Katrina Kelleher, former AmeriCorps member serving with Umpqua Watersheds, who is now the GIS specialist for the Northwest Indian Fisheries Commission. To start things off, can you tell us a little about the Northwest Indian Fisheries Commission? Why was it established?
Sure. So the Northwest Indian Fisheries Commission, I refer to it as the commission. Some people refer to it as NWIFC, but it's an organization that supports the 20 treaty tribes of Western Washington with natural resource management projects. It was created after the 1974 U.S. versus Washington Bolt decision ruling that reaffirmed the tribe's treaty reserved fishing rights. So it recognized the tribes as co-managers along with the state of Washington, who have rights to an equal share of the harvestable number of salmon that return each year. Yeah, I've been working there for about a year and a half now.
Awesome. So it seems like it's kind of related to, you know, Native American or Indigenous rights kind of too.
It is, yeah. Right. The organization is not, you know, I don't technically work for a tribal entity, but I work for an organization that supports the 20 tribes and their natural resource projects.
So what's your involvement more specifically? How is GIS used?
Yeah, sort of a loaded question. I'm involved in a number of projects, and as I'm sure you can imagine with 20 tribes, there is a lot of projects taking place. So my role is to support tribes with GIS, so mapping projects, data analysis projects, and data management, so managing their environmental data. Many of the tribes collect water quality data annually, pretty robust water quality data sets. They collect riparian habitat data. They conduct restoration projects. I kind of support them with whatever is needed at the time.
Yeah, I learned a little bit about GIS and practiced with GIS and GPS mapping last year during my term. But it seems pretty complicated. My understanding is that, yeah, like you were saying with data management, kind of a place where people can go and see different layers of data. So you mentioned about fisheries or riparian data. But yeah, no, it seems like a really neat way to compile information in kind of an electronic way.
It is, yeah. And a lot of data that tribes collect is spatial. So it all has a GIS component.
I understand that you've done some research on climate change, specifically riparian microclimate. Can you explain or share some of your findings?
Sure. So for my master's thesis research, I got my master's in environmental studies and GIS from the Evergreen State College in 2019. And so for my master's thesis research, I studied microclimate, which is and isn't related to climate change, but it's definitely impacted by climate change. But it's really like a small area, the climate for a really, really small area. So it can differ, you know, within pretty, pretty major ways across a small area. So I specifically looked at riparian microclimates on the Olympic Peninsula and examined ecological indicators that influence riparian microclimates in riparian management zones. So for in terms of microclimate variables, I looked at air temperature, vapor pressure deficit, which is similar to the humidity, and then cumulative degree days. And then I looked at a number of predictor variables like distance from stream, height above stream, percent shade or canopy closure, as well as solar radiation received at each site. And I found that this is probably not going to come to a surprise to many of your listeners who are science-minded and, you know a lot about forestry and conservation, but found that, you know, riparian microclimate's really complicated and riparian management zones are incredibly complex and we, you know, don't know very much about them. And our current forest practices, laws and regulations are based on a pretty limited set of science. So I found actually that height above stream was a better indicator, much better indicator of microclimate variables than distance from stream. And that's pretty interesting when you think about how riparian buffers are designated. In almost every situation, it's by distance from stream. So my findings kind of suggest that, you know, more than just distance should be considered when establishing, you know, riparian areas. I'm actually in the process of publishing this data, so it'll be my first published peer-reviewed journal. I'm really excited.
That's awesome. Yeah, I was wondering when you were talking, do you know if anyone else is kind of continuing that data, or are you continuing some research on that? Seems like important work to be out there.
Yeah, that's a good question. So I worked with the Washington State Department of Natural Resources on this project, and this is part of a larger project in the Olympic Experimental State Forest, which is DNR managed land, and they are conducting quite a bit of long-term monitoring in various areas. Microclimate is one of them. So they actually were the ones who set up the microclimate stations. It was 5 years ago now. I just came in and analyzed all their data for them. So they get the credit for creating the study design, and they're continuing that research. So there's definitely going to be more, mainly graduate students, looking at the relationships that they're collecting.
That's great. Where can people learn more if they want to, you know, find that research, or where is it going to be published, I guess?
So I'm submitting it to a journal called Northwest Science, and I can let you all know when it gets accepted and when it's going to be published. I'm hoping this year, maybe summer. Stay tuned.
That's awesome. Well, congratulations ahead of time.
Thank you.
What are some of the challenges that you've encountered and or that Native Americans or Indigenous people continue to face? So kind of bringing together some of your different work and experience.
Yeah. Well, I think one of the greatest challenges that tribes are facing and will continue to face is related to climate change and human population growth and what comes with that, which is habitat degradation and development. And, you know, tribes are leading the way and have been since time immemorial when it comes to land management and land preservation. And I think a challenge that, you know, they face is that, you know, in Washington State and in Oregon, in this region, land is managed by many different entities. It's not just managed by tribes. It's not just managed by the state. It's not just, you know, managed by the federal government. It's managed by, you know, private entities. It's managed by all these different agencies, all these different organizations. And I think that conglomerate of management styles is, you know, really messing with our, you know, larger ecosystem and the systems that intricately require connectivity, habitat connectivity. You know, that doesn't exist in a lot of cases. So I think what tribes are dealing with is mismanagement from that, that's out of their control, that's out of their, you know, current jurisdiction, that is trickling into their lands that they're managing. So it's kind of scary thinking about what our landscape is going to look like in, you know, the decades to come with our changing climate.
Yeah, thank you for sharing that. Yeah, it seems like we're dealing with some really complex and interwoven issues. I think some people mistakenly simplify things a bit too much. You know, environmentalists and others aren't necessarily protecting trees just because we like trees, though we do really like trees. I think there's a greater understanding of, you know, that interconnectedness. Trees are home to owls who keep rodent populations in check. Rodents and owls in turn help to spread fungal spores and mycelium, which help the trees to grow. And then tree roots hold moisture and help prevent soil erosion. You know, everything's so connected in such big ways and little ways. yeah, I think like thinking about some of that interconnectedness, those complexities, and based on your experience, what recommendations would you make for people in the Pacific Northwest going forward?
Yeah, well, you know, something you didn't mention too is that trees, especially old trees and, you know, healthy forests are excellent carbon sinks. Moving forward, I mean, I think it's important for people to think about the bigger picture and take a step back. And it's really important to get the right people who are science-minded and who recognize the value of big trees and of healthy, you know, robust, resilient landscapes and of conservation. It's important to get these people into leadership roles. And it's important to vote those people in and participate in the voting process and participate in hard conversations about policies. And, you know, I'm more of a science-minded person, not so much a policy kind of person, but I recognize that, you know, they need to mix. The interdisciplinary thinking is the way forward, and it's the way that, you know, we're going to create positive change and preserve the little landscape that we have left. And, you know, just thinking back to the tribes that I work with, they do a lot of incredible work with state and federal agencies, with other tribes. And they're working on these landscape scale restoration projects that are really impressive and give me a lot of hope. Climate change is a really sad, draining topic. And I studied it in undergrad. I've studied components of it in grad school, and then I work with climate change related data for work. And sometimes I feel like there's nothing we can do, and like, we're too far gone. I see, you know, bad policies being created and implemented, and think, you know, oh boy, like, how can we possibly be making things worse at this point when the science is sound, and when we know that we need to be preserving the habitat we have left and working, you know, on restoration projects at way greater scales than we are and that we have funding for. But I think like what snaps me out of that thinking is when I think of the positive restoration projects happening, when I think of all of the positive changes we are seeing, you know, as small as they are, a lot of them are happening. And if you get really discouraged to the point where you don't want to participate in the conversations, or to the point where you just want to sit back and, you know, live your life, that's okay. But for me personally, you know, I don't find that productive. And there is a lot worth celebrating. So I think that that's important to keep in mind.
We'll be right back after a few brief announcements. Is there an environmentally related issue you'd like to solve? Perhaps you're passionate about recycling, waste management, clean water, protection of old growth forests, wildlife rescue, reducing cat or dog overpopulation, picking up litter, or organic farming. If you're interested in exploring one of these solutions or have an idea for another way to solve a local problem, be sure to sign up for the Eco Innovations Challenge. You'll have a chance to gain financial and volunteer support to put your plan into action. Contact Ryan at umpquawatersheds.org to learn more. And now back to Living Downstream.
Yeah, thank you so much. I know that it can be so overwhelming because climate change is so big and so complicated. And I think just the predicted things that are likely to happen are so bad. You know, I've heard of it described as like, it's not necessarily that we'll have, I mean, sometimes we'll have more of things that are happening, but it'll also just kind of exacerbate what's already happening. So the storms will be worse, or the droughts will be longer, or, you know, when it floods, there'll be a bigger flood or something. So it's going to be, you know, really impactful.
Yeah,
in a lot of places.
Look what's happening across the country right now. You know, like how many Texans are left without power and without water, and, you know, they don't even have snow shovels because they're not used to getting snow. And like, that's something I think that could come out of this tragedy that's happening across our country right now, is like, I hope this wakes people up and makes people realize like, okay, climate change is happening and it's here, and it might look like weird snowstorms in places it's never happened. but that's directly related to what we are doing to our planet, and our entire system is out of whack, and that's clear. And it's a shame because it's not the people who are necessarily being impacted right now. It's not their fault. You know, I don't want to place blame, but it's not the little people's fault. and yet, you know, they're the ones who are feeling the impacts.
Yeah. And I was deciding on the name for this show, Living Downstream. Part of why I chose the name was the idea of, you know, sometimes we put something into the water, but it's not impacting our water. You know, it gets taken downstream to somebody else and they have to deal with it and clean up the mess. And I think that that's something really important to remember. You know, even if we, you know, whether it's us or our listeners or whoever, if we cut down trees somewhere, you know, it impacts somebody else, whether it's a different species or, you know, different people down the line, you know, our kids and grandkids. And we need to really think about what we do and how that has an impact and plays a role in this larger system that we're all a part of.
Yeah, I think that's a great name. And just look at, you know, what your and my generations have inherited from older generations, and, you know, what we are going to leave for generations behind us. It's not fair to the younger generations at all.
But it's good to remember, like you said, that there's always something we can do to not give up hope, right? Even though things are starting to happen, we also can make changes, and we can do things to kind of either reverse the tide or hold it back a little bit. Yeah, well, thank you so much for being on the show.
Sure.
Is there anything else you'd like to add?
I guess for anyone interested in the Northwest Indian Fisheries Commission, we just completed a report. It's almost 400 pages, so it's basically a book called The State of Our Watersheds Report. So State of Our Watersheds 2020 report. And we completed hundreds of analyses on different environmental indicators across Western Washington in various tribal areas of interest. But I would definitely recommend checking that out. You can just Google State of Our Watersheds 2020 report, take a look, and there's a lot of really good information in there, and including a lot of hopeful examples of, you know, positive restoration projects that have been completed or are being conducted by tribes across Western Washington.
That's great. Well, thank you so much for sharing that resource.
Sure. Yeah, sure thing.
So you mentioned about how, you know, tribal groups work together, whether it's across tribal boundaries or whatever, or with other groups, but that, you know, there are lots of impacts from other entities. So I was thinking about how, so Umpqua Watershed, I learned and was excited to find out, is I think one of the only watersheds that's also, you know, the watershed boundary is also the county boundary. Yeah. So where I was serving prior to this over in Vermont, I was helping with another watershed organization, but we had like half the watershed that we were able to do something with, and the other half was in a different state. And I think it's important for people to kind of think about and remember that different ecoregions or kind of natural boundaries don't always line up as nicely as they do in Douglas County. They don't always line up with, you know, kind of these established human-made lines, right, that aren't actually there. We just are, you know, demarcating, okay, we're going to have this be the border. So it's crucially important that we do work together because, you know, the habitats stretch over multiple states or counties or that kind of thing. I don't know. I guess just do you have any thoughts on that?
That's a really good point. And right. Watershed boundaries don't usually correlate with county boundaries. Maybe Douglas County's Oregon is the only one in the region. I'm not sure. That's a struggle. Different jurisdictions yield totally different land management strategies. And it's a constant struggle from, you know, really local scales where developers are moving in and want to turn a park into some expensive housing units. And it exists on a greater scale. I mean, even like state or country level scales, you know, Canada is right across the border of Washington State, and their forest practices are completely different than ours, worse in a lot of ways. They have almost no old growth remaining. Same with us, unfortunately. But I think that that's a really good thing to consider. And when thinking about what needs to happen for large scale change, it's going to require collaboration across multiple entities, across multiple countries, across, you know, different people with different backgrounds, people with different understandings. And that's really hard. I think everyone would agree that that's hard. And then, you know, then you have to, you know, think about competing interests and money and what projects are funded and what aren't. We'll never get bored. I guess that's a positive to all of this is we might get burnt out, but we won't get bored.
There's always something to do. Yeah, it's important to learn from the other groups who are doing things or have done something before. You know, when I learned that Europe, you know, if we think about, okay, like people, well, different groups are in different places, right? And then like colonized or whatever. But like, so back a long time ago in Europe, a lot of the forests were cut down and different things happened. And so then people came, like there were already people in the US, but then other people came to the US and were like, oh, like more resources for us. We can use this. But we should be learning from the past, right? That whole history is bound to repeat itself. Like if we keep doing this, it's going to keep happening and keep getting worse. And we have all the information we need, kind of to a certain extent. We have what we need in terms of, you know, certain understandings and or past practices that didn't work that we could learn from. And yeah, if only we could come together and try to make positive change. We're all one big, you know, world family, you know, one species as a whole. So if we could, I don't know, like act like a big family instead of kind of all these, you know, separate groups.
That would be nice. Yeah, that would be really nice. One thing we don't have is a brain capacity that is good at thinking in the long term. We're really good at thinking about short term needs, short term solutions. So when it comes to like the scale of the environmental degradation that's happening worldwide right now, it's like our little brains cannot possibly fathom the systemic issues at play. A lot of us are also not good at systems thinking in general. So that is where, you know, the collective mindset comes in. And I think like collectively, we can all understand and grasp the problems. I can talk a lot about riparian microclimate, but when I zoom out and I talk about, you know, wide scale albedo effect or Arctic amplification or, glaciers melting, my brain just kind of goes like, whoa, like that's out of my league. That's like out of my realm of knowledge. But there's people who are experts in that. And The information is there. So even though on individual scales, biologically, we sort of have some pea brains going on, collectively, we have a big giant brain that's pretty functional.
That's a neat way to think about it, but that's so true. Yeah. Like if we try to tackle everything ourselves, we can't, you know, whether it's a specific, you know, event and we're trying to plan an event, you can't do everything. Right. And this is like a worldwide event, right? So no one can do all of it, but we all can work together to do some part of it. So that's great.
Just thinking of the Umpqua Brew Fest, thinking of how many people and how many hours it takes to put an event like that on, or any of the Umpqua Watersheds events, the banquets. It's very true. Yeah, everyone has a part to play.
Keep an eye and ear out for an upcoming climate change show, which will be taking place on KQA in the next couple of months.
Today we have Stuart Leibowitz from the Douglas County Global Warming Coalition. When and why was the Douglas County Global Warming Coalition established?
Well, I've been involved and interested in climate change and global warming for about 30 years and followed the issue very closely. And in 2004, I received a video produced by the BBC from my sister who lives in England, and it's a video called The Day the Oceans Boiled. And it was a very compelling story of how there is an historical evidence over time that there is a possibility that we would reach a tipping point where the Amazon would burn and oceans would boil, releasing methane, causing a catastrophic chain reaction on global warming, and that if we didn't take steps to curtail that, we would again see that replicated. So myself and a few others decided to show this video at the library, and to our surprise and thrill, quite honestly, 150 people showed up to watch this video. And it was so compelling, it was clear that we needed to form an organization, which we did, and set up a board, and that was in 2004. And we have been growing and ongoing for about 17 years now. And we have a membership list of approximately 450. And so, but this was the genesis of the Global Warming Coalition. And what I always felt was that we were ahead of the game in regards to sounding the alarm in terms of the coming climate catastrophe and the need to address that in bold strokes. And so that is how the coalition was formed, and we have been very active in a variety of areas ever since.
Wow. Yeah, it sounds like there definitely was interest initially and that there has been increased interest over the years. So that's great. Have you been able to do different activities with, you know, COVID and everything? I know a lot of groups have gone virtual or had to kind of, you know, slow down on the programming and such.
Yeah, it's like, I suspect like most organizations, we have had obstacles and challenges in regards to the pandemic. And to give you a little bit of historical background, what we have done in the past is have yearly forums with experts addressing various aspects of climate change. We've had everyone from Dr. Philip Mote, who is a contributor to the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, to Jane Luchenko, who's the head of the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration, and others talking about what the specific elements of climate change and results are. Obviously, with the pandemic, this has proven to be not workable at this time. So what we have done is to hold, like others, Zoom meetings and events that try to at least circumvent and accommodate that. So, for example, on Earth Day, last Earth Day, when we normally would be in the forefront of organizing an Earth Day and Energy Fair, we invited individuals to share on their Facebook, on our Facebook, their feelings on the 50th anniversary of Earth Day. We have also assembled a stakeholder Zoom meeting to try and figure out ways to promote and enhance the electrification of our transportation system, most notably electric vehicles. We also have in the offing coming down the road a solar and green tour that will be held virtually. We have done this in person for the last 16 years or more than that, 17 years or so, where we have people visit homes throughout Douglas County that show the latest in green and solar technology. Obviously, that is not something we can plan on in the near term, but we are working with Energy Trust of Oregon to see if we can have a regional green and solar tour that is done virtually. So these are some of the ways we've been trying to accommodate ourselves in light of the pandemic. And clearly, we, like everybody else, look forward to the time when we can get everybody vaccinated and get back to in-person events that will really bolster our efforts. The other thing that we are concentrating on significantly is the executive order on climate change that was issued by Governor Brown approximately 1 year ago, and we are very heavily involved in that as well, holding virtual meetings with our allies across the state, as well as monitoring the efforts of the various agencies to implement this very important executive order. So that's kind of a thumbnail sketch of what we've been involved in over the last year, given the limitations that we are all facing due to the pandemic.
Can you review what the executive order, that legislation, had to do with?
Yes, and I'll take a step back and give a little bit of history first. We have been involved with our allies across the state to try and pass legislation that was known as Cap and Invest. And what that was a bill, and it was introduced back, I think, around 2017 or so, which would cap and reduce the greenhouse gas emissions over time, consistent with the best science, and set up what we call a trading system, which would generate enough money to spend on renewable energy and other ways to further reduce global warming emissions in our state. And in 2020, we were on the cusp of getting that passed. We had overwhelming majorities in the Senate and the House on the state level, and we're absolutely prepared to get this passed. The governor was behind it, and the Speaker of the House and the Senate, President of the Senate was behind it. And then the Republicans decided that the only way they could stop this was to take the anti-democratic step of basically leaving the state and denying us a quorum to even conduct business. So that was an immense frustration after spending 3 years working on this very important piece of legislation. Fortunately, Governor Brown, in March of last year, issued the executive order on climate change, which mandated several things. First mandate was to lower greenhouse gas emissions 80% below 1990 levels by 2050. The second thing that it does is set up a benchmark in between so we don't wait till 2049 to get the emissions reduction that we need. And so the benchmark would be 2035, where emissions would be reduced 45%, and that would be the interim benchmark. In addition, it required agencies throughout the state to implement this within the context of their charge. So what does that mean? It means that there are roughly, I think, 19 state agencies that are working on this right now, and there are six main agencies that we and our allies are monitoring, participating in, and working closely with to make sure that that this executive order is implemented. The devil, of course, is in the details. And we are running into, as expected, resistance on the agency level because this is new, this is different. And the industrial polluters have gotten their foot in the door and obviously are pushing back on that and trying to limit the power of the executive order. In fact, they instituted a lawsuit trying to stop it, which was rejected in the courts and maybe on appeal, but it was rejected at that, at this point. Now, the efforts that we're involved in basically covers five or six very important agencies.
Yeah, thank you for sharing that information. I'm not originally from Oregon, so I don't know some of the history and background, so it's helpful to learn about it. How has climate change impacted Southern Oregon or the Pacific Northwest so far?
Okay, there are primarily two elements to climate change that have had some very significant impacts in Oregon, and particularly Southern Oregon. The first I would talk about is ocean acidification. And in that regard, it has had an effect on the ability of shellfish to reproduce and stay healthy because of the increased acidification that has resulted from the combination of carbon dioxide chemically reacting with the water. And the shellfish industry has had to accommodate that as best they can along the coast. Several years back, one of our forums featured Dr. Francis Chan of Oregon State University, who spoke in great detail as to the dangers not only of what we're facing now, but what we will face in the future because carbon dioxide is still being released into the atmosphere. To kind of put this in perspective, Dr. Jane Luchenko, who was the head of NOAA, who I referenced earlier, called ocean acidification global warming's evil twin. And that is something that people do not necessarily talk about a lot, but that is very dangerous to our fisheries, and particularly the shellfish industry. So that's one element that Southern Oregon has had to cope with. Second one, and I know that people are very familiar with, is wildfires. And that has had a very devastating effect in Southern Oregon. And the combination of droughts and forest management have combined, in essence, to increase not only the intensity but the frequency of wildfires, which unfortunately we have seen most recently. And according to the National Climate Assessment that was released in 2018, this phenomenon will only get worse rather than better. And so this is something we need to be very cognizant of, take steps to protect ourselves from. And unfortunately, this is a ramification of climate change that we will see in the coming years ahead.
Yeah, I think some of the impacts, like kind of impending doom, can be so overwhelming. I always try to think about where we can find hope. What can people do about all of this? You know, what changes can the average listener take to really, you know, start making changes in the right direction if we want to reverse some of these negative impacts?
Clearly, what we have concluded in our organization, there are two levels one can operate under. The simplest level is to take steps individually to reduce your own personal carbon footprint in terms of driving, which represents roughly 40% of all greenhouse gas emissions in the state. Energy efficiency and weatherization, those steps can also be taken to reduce the amount of carbon that you're responsible for in your home. You can, you know, shift over to a Blue Sky program if you are a Pacific Power customer, which means a portion of your bill will go toward renewable energy. So those are some simple steps you can take. But we've also concluded that the larger issue requires much more intense efforts. And by that we mean involvement in legislative efforts, both on the state level and the federal level. So what we look for in regards to our members and the public at large is to be willing to contact their legislators when bills come up that are crucial to lowering greenhouse gas emissions. And one example is there was a bill before the legislative session this year which would require that we ultimately have 100% clean renewable energy as part of our electricity mix. So that's one bill that we are monitoring closely. There are other bills in terms of promoting and subsidizing further the electrification of our transportation system. And the governor has a bill, an omnibus transportation bill, which incorporates increased subsidies, particularly for low and moderate income households. So those are some examples, and we are monitoring every day, every week, the status of these bills. Hearings come up almost unannounced until the last day or two, and so we try to let our members know that this is the time to contact our representatives and urge them to support these important measures. The other element, of course, is working with us on the executive order. And there have been moments where personal testimony to these agencies on the various aspects of the executive order are most timely, and we welcome people's participation in that as well. So people can work on a variety of levels, from the personal to the macro, if you will, in regards to doing everything we can to battle this climate crisis that we are all in. And for us, this is the greatest issue of our time. It is basically the life and death of our planet as we know it. And all other issues, at least from my perspective, are subjugated to the survival of the planet. For if we do not have a survivable planet, no other issue can come to the fore in a meaningful way.
Yeah, no, that's such an important point. During an earlier conversation with me, you stated that climate change continues regardless of who's elected. And I thought that that was a really important message as well, because sometimes it seems like people are thinking like, oh, like it doesn't impact me, or, well, I'm going to go along with the policies that this person says or that person says, I can, continue with the same types of things, continue the status quo, that kind of thing. But really we can't, we need to make some pretty significant changes, as you mentioned.
Let me kind of preface my statement in the following way. As an organization that has a fiscal sponsor who is a 501c3, we are not legally allowed to take a stand on any particular candidate. So that's a restriction that we need to honor. But as I previously mentioned, irrespective of who's in office, we are very much active in the legislative arena, and it is absolutely critical in terms of defining a political issue. It is absolutely critical that we work toward legislation, meaningful legislation, and even more important, the implementation of that legislation to make sure that the climate crisis is addressed. And we operate both on the local, the state, and the national level. And they complement each other. And so we need to be aware of what's going on the state level so Oregon can do its share to reduce global warming emissions. We need to operate on the national level. There are bills on the national level that are being considered, everything from electric bike subsidies to infrastructure and the like. And we need to be right up front in putting pressure on our representatives to make this the primary issue. It's very easy to sit back and think, well, we have a representative who is supportive of working on climate change. But it is equally important to let that representative know that not only is it important, it is the primary issue. So then these representatives have a variety of issues in front of them, and there are a lot of important things to work on. This really needs to rise to the top, and that's why we cannot be lax in letting our representatives know how important it is to act on these climate change bills, both on the national and the state level.
Yeah, because it seems like there are some really different actions taken based on what party is in office. And it's unfortunate to me because, you know, climate change issues are impacting everyone. And I wish that everyone could realize what an impact we have, you know, as individuals, as a collective, on everyone else. The whole idea with this radio program being named Living Downstream is kind of getting at that, right? That we impact people downstream of wherever we are, or, you know, whether it's in the future generations, or just location wise, you know, the wildfire smoke ended up in Europe, you know, from here. So the things that we do or different actions that we take can have far reaching impacts. So it's really important that we try to help move those positive in terms of environmental protection, positive things forward. I understand that your organization seeks to bring different people to the table, you know, to share different perspectives. I was wondering if you could share some things that you've learned from some of those interactions.
Yeah, I'm glad you brought that up. We had this great idea for last Earth Day. And the idea was to bring a variety of environmental groups together to celebrate the 50th anniversary of Earth Day. In fact, I was working closely with the watersheds to make that happen when the pandemic went out of control and basically eliminated that possibility. And so what happened instead was I wound up submitting a guest column noting the contributions of all the environmental organizations that had originally wanted to participate, Watersheds, Audubon, and the like. And in fact, we had, I think, roughly seven or eight organizations that had initially agreed to do that. But to more directly answer your question, we have co-sponsored forums in the past with other organizations in regards to how climate change has impact in respect to what their issues have been. So, as an example, we co-sponsored a forum with Audubon in regards to how climate change is impacting the survival of various birds across the globe. We've also co-sponsored forums with Umpqua Watersheds in terms of the impact on stream flows and rivers and the like. Again, it's all intertwined. So what we look at is a very holistic approach on the impacts of climate change, because it permeates every aspect of our environment, both in terms of biological diversity, in terms of human impact. And so we welcome and work with as many organizations as we can who have come to recognize as well that we're all tied together on this one. And so that historically has been something we have done, and we look forward, once this pandemic is brought under control, to reaching out once more and hold forums, the educational events that allow various groups with us to present the climate change perspective from their issue.
Yeah, I think partnerships and collaboration are so important, especially on this global issue that really is impacting everyone. And, you know, I think it's only going to be through collaboration and working together to solve it that we will be able to solve it. You know, if we can take those small steps in separate places, but if we work as separate little islands or silos, then we're not going to make the real, you know, the big and lasting change that we need to kind of reverse some of these impacts that are starting to happen.
Yeah, I also wanted to further comment on something that you had brought up. In essence, how it impacts everybody. When the wildfires happen and the homes are destroyed or your fisheries are devastated, it doesn't ask your party affiliation. It doesn't ask what organization you're a member of. We are all impacted together on this. That's what makes this a real universal issue, a nonpartisan issue. And it requires us to work together because we cannot do this separately. And so it's imperative that we work together as a community, as an environmental community as well, to make this happen.
Yeah, thank you for sharing that. You mentioned about having an event around Earth Fair, around Earth Day. So I just wanted to let you know. So I'm helping to coordinate a weekend of service through Umpqua Watersheds, and I'm going to see if other AmeriCorps members would like to add events or contribute as well. But April 24th and 25th, so that's the weekend after Earth Day, we're going to be doing a river cleanup on Saturday and an eco-innovation challenge on Sunday. So I can get you some more information about that, but a couple of small notes about it. The river cleanup, we're trying to be as COVID safe as possible. So we're having people sign up in family groups or COVID exposure groups, people they're already interacting with regularly. And we'll have separate sites rather than everyone congregating together. People will kind of go to their separate locations. We'll do garbage cleanups from those locations so that, yeah, their exposure to other people is limited. And then we'll also be doing this Eco Innovations Challenge, which will ask community members to submit proposals of ideas, possible solutions to environmental problems in the local area. And then they'll have a chance to present and potentially gain both financial support and volunteer support or organizational support to start putting some of those ideas into practice. So just trying to kind of, you know, bring additional people into the fold. So I wanted to let you know about both of those opportunities coming up as well. Is there anything else you'd like to share with our listeners, either how they can learn more about your organization or what they can do about climate change or, you know, contacting people to make sure that climate change policies stay, you know, a top priority, any of those types of things?
Well, I just wanted to elaborate just a little bit on the executive order, if I can.
Okay.
And basically, there are five or six agencies that we are working very closely with along with our state allies. And this is an opportunity for people to become involved. Just to mention them very briefly, the Oregon Health Authority has issued a report on the health impacts of climate change in Oregon, and they have a special section on rural communities, and we are working with them. We're working with the Department of Transportation, and they are looking at an analysis as to where the gaps are in electric charging stations. We are also organizing a group to further electrification in Douglas County. And also in regards to the executive order, the Department of Environmental Quality is rolling out various scenarios on how to meet the targets. We're trying to make sure that they cover all the bases. Sometimes agencies do not, and that's one of the things that we have discovered. So those are some of the groups that we have been involved in, also the Public Utility Commission in terms of energy efficiency standards that could be utilized to meet the executive order mandates that were initially put together. I'll also add that our state allies are preparing a scorecard for these various agencies on the first anniversary of the executive order on March 10th. So for people who want to be involved in what I consider the most important piece of legislation, effort in the state of Oregon on climate change, we would certainly welcome contacting us and letting us know how they wish to participate. We can certainly get them involved as well. And so I would urge people to do so.
Great. Yeah, no, the scorecards sound interesting. You know, I'm a former teacher, so they remind me of rubrics. You know, if we're trying to assess, you know, the quality of what people are doing, it's good to have a way to do that that lets them know, okay, like these are the areas for improvement.
Yeah, and just to give a little plug not only to our organization, but also to Watersheds, we have been running 30-second spots on KQAW. with the idea of saying, here's the latest tidbit of information on climate change, and here are the things that you can do. And we rotate these spots every couple of weeks, so there's new information. So for those who are listening to CAQUA, you have the opportunity to hear the latest scientific information that we've been able to glean, and also offer ways that you can be a participant in forging a clean energy future for ourselves and for future generations.
Awesome. Yeah, I think some of those are incorporated in, you know, interspersed through both my show and other shows that I've listened to as well. So yeah, they're definitely being aired, and I think it's really helpful for people to have that educational component, you know, to hear the newest data, because sometimes if we're not seeking it, you know, we're not listening to the, if certain people aren't listening to the news or they're not really tied in, they don't actually know how severe some of these problems are. So I'm, you know, I'm grateful that you and your organization are sharing that information, and hopefully it can get to a wider audience. And I really appreciate you being on the show today and, you know, just sharing some of what your organization is doing, as well as, yeah, just the importance of this issue in this time. You know, climate change is, like you said, going to impact everyone, and it's not going to depend on whether we're a good person or a bad person, or if we live here or there. I mean, it'll impact people differently depending on where they live, certainly, but yeah, it's not gonna check, yeah, like, are you from this party or are you in this organization? And yeah, we need to really work together to make the changes that need to happen.
Absolutely. And I appreciate your inviting me to talk about our organization, and most importantly, this critical issue of our time.
Yes, thank you so much.